always leave yourself a back door. What does that mean? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller, who is a CFI based in the Buffalo, New York area. He puts out Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, and we have Bob on pretty much every Monday to talk about a safety topic to kind of get our head on straight to start the week. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, as always, Paul.
Bob, in your latest edition of Over the Airwaves, you revisited the topic of back doors, and we have talked about this from time to time, and you often mention it in conjunction with other topics, but you made a few specific examples I wanted to talk about today with you. And some of them have to do with this time of year, but some of them are valid any time. First of all, explain what a backdoor is.
A backdoor is another term that I use for Plan B or an aid to assist us in our go, no-go decision making. If we take off and assume a particular flight parameter and something goes wrong, do we have a Plan B? Can we go in another direction, or can we exercise another option that would produce a safe outcome? That's what I call a backdoor.
All right. Now, today, of all days, you mentioned that you had to take one of those backdoors. Bob Miller, comma, proponent of training in winds, comma, canceled a flight because you had a 40-knot wind right down the runway in Buffalo, New York. Why did you cancel that flight?
Well, a 40-knot wind, if it's right down the runway, is really a no-brainer. We can take off easily into that. In fact, takeoffs into high headwinds, the airplane seems to perform a whole lot better.
Yeah, it's like a Cessna helicopter.
Yeah, exactly. The problem is always taxiing. Taxiing to the runway in a 30 to 40-knot gusty wind can be problematic because at some point in that taxi, we're going to have to turn the airplane perpendicular to the winds. And in a high-wing airplane such as a 172 that I was scheduled to operate today, that becomes like a great big wind umbrella to catch it. We also, at the airport I was operating, has a fair amount of maneuvering to get to the runway between rows of hangars and things like this, which would create additional risks in the event that the airplane were to be turned or turned into the wind or on ice where braking is minimal. So there is a case, here is a case where a backdoor simply didn't exist from the taxiing perspective.
Well, when we talk about backdoors, we have to acknowledge the fact that in some activities, some decision processes, there's not going to be one. We just have to say not today.
Yes, and that's what I experienced today. Not today. There just wasn't a suitable way to control the airplane on the ground. And I oftentimes look at how am I going to explain a mishap to either the insurance company or to an administrative law judge in the event that there was a mishap during conditions such as today. So the question really became easy. Both I and my student understood quickly that no flying today.
Now, we have talked about some of the backdoors that you look for, and specifically we've talked a lot lately about icing conditions where your backdoors are essentially warmer or drier. Yeah, I mean, you have to find one or the other, and you have to know that you can find one or the other if you're going to continue flying through these, realistically, even in an aircraft that's designed to handle icing conditions. But let's talk about a few that don't come up often. You have mentioned in Over the Airwaves that a night takeoff over cold water is one of your least favorite things to do. Tell us why.
No backdoor. Night takeoff over cold water. I think immediately Toronto Island Airport near Toronto up in Lake Ontario. That's an overwater takeoff at night. And we just simply don't like to. I don't like to do it in a single engine airplane because there are no back doors. If the engine fails, we're going to go into the water, and depending on how far we are from the airport, it may be a long wait in the water before somebody is able to get us. In the winter time, such as now, it's almost a no option maneuver for me because there just is not a safe back door.
Now, you've talked about traveling with your family in your Cessna, and you have a four-person life draft. That's a back door, but if you're flying over frigid water, you mentioned it. You know, it comes down now to a decision of, do I want to have to go through that back door?
Well, that was a clear example that occurred last year on a flight I took from the Laurentians back across Lake Ontario during the day in February in my Cessna 210, and felt comfort in the fact that I had, of course, a four-man life raft in the airplane, life preservers for everybody. Per the regulations, I was perfectly legal, but there was a teaching moment that occurred to me as I pondered halfway across the lake, beyond the gliding range of land, that if I had to do it, what would be the likelihood of surviving in that frigid cold water? And it became apparent to me that survival would not be possible for more than 5 or 10 minutes. That was indeed an acute learning experience for me, and I offer that up as an example that even experienced pilots occasionally can overlook the absence of a back door. Having a life raft and life jackets on board the airplane is fine over open water in the summertime. But if we're flying over frigid cold water, a life jacket and a life raft is going to do us very little good. If there is a possibility we're going to get wet getting into the life raft. So we have to look at those mitigating factors. We have to think about water temperature. We have to think whether it's day or night. I mean, we can even go into warmer water at night, but realistically, search and rescue is not going to find us until 5 or 6 hours later into the next day. So whenever contemplating back doors, let's not make an assumption that we have them all canned in our brain. We have to think of each one each time we operate.
Well, here's a painful question, too. As we get older, does the prospect of going into the water sound less and less appealing?
Yeah, that's right. I think younger or older, the prospect of going into very cold water is very unappealing to most of us.
All right, Bob. We're ending up talking a lot about water, but there's a great story I want you to tell when we get back about an anecdote about a trip over the Hudson River that I'm going to have you tell when we get back from our break here.
Okay.
My guest is Bob Miller, who is a CFI based in the Buffalo area and who puts out Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller, CFI, who puts out Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, and who has recently opened his own flight school in the Buffalo, New York area at the Lancaster Airport to put some of the things he's been writing and talking about for years into practice in the flight school environment. Bob, I want to ask you to tell a story that was related to you by a reader about one of your trips into New York, because you had written about flying over the Hudson River at 500 feet, and your contention was that even though you could have flown as high as 1,100 feet, at that point it wouldn't really make a whole lot of difference because the back door was going to be a splash regardless. Tell us what happened when you conversed with this listener.
This is an excellent example of when writing something in Over the Airwaves or talking about it here on a podcast. Oftentimes I make statements or people make statements that we believe are sound, but will be later corrected by a reader or a listener. And I openly admit to one that occurred a month or so ago in Over the Airwaves when I described our New York City trips going up the VFR Hudson Corridor. Some portions of that trip have to be done below 500 feet to get below the New York class Bravo airspace. But once out over the river, the airspace allows you to go up to 1,100 feet. And, well, being at 500 feet, we're getting a fantastic view, and I related that to my readers. Soon after it was posted on the web, I received an email from a reader who challenged me on that and said, Bob, for a person who, certainly supports safety and encourages safe practices, he said, I don't understand why you would fly that trip at 500 feet up the Hudson when you could go as high as 1,100. And I quickly retorted saying, well, friend, if the engine failed at 1,100 feet or 500 feet, regardless, you're going to get wet. You're going to go into the water. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, he said, it makes a big difference. And he asked me if I recalled an accident that occurred several years ago where a Piper Warrior actually did encounter such an experience and had to land in the Hudson River just south of the George Washington Bridge. And I said, yes, you know, I do vaguely remember that. And he said, well, that was me. And my ears perked up, and I said, tell me more. And he said, well, this is the reason I'm calling you. I happen to be at 1,100 feet instead of the 500 feet that you recommended when my engine failed. Failed suddenly. I had enough time to issue a mayday call on 121.5. After the first call, there was no answer. Gliding down just before splashdown, I was able to get another call out on 121.5, and a news helicopter picked up my mayday call and asked me my position. I told them we were where we were going in, and he arrived moments later on an amphibious helicopter and was able to extract myself, me, and my passenger out of the water, and obviously we survived the event. He said, had I been at the 500 feet that you recommended, Bob, that second mayday call never could have taken place, and the outcome may have been far less pleasant than what I encountered. So this is a situation that, as I said earlier, even experienced pilots will make judgment calls based upon their experience, but if they really stop to think about it, is there a backdoor that is better or perhaps non-existent at some flight parameter that we happen to be in? And that was a lesson that I certainly learned, and now we do those Hudson River tours at the highest possible altitude, 1,100 feet, believe me.
You know, as a longtime ham radio operator, I think I'm kind of sensitized to think about, do I have communications from here? But I think the same kind of thing applies if you're flying between ridges or in terrain where if you lose a few hundred feet of altitude, you might suddenly find yourself unable to communicate with anyone.
Well, that's, again, an excellent example of, you know, flying down through valleys over the Rockies, for example. If you lose radio communication, or if you have any kind of a mishap, will anybody hear you if you're able to put out, if you put out a mayday call down there? That's another excellent example, Paul.
Well, I don't want to get out of this without talking about one of the backdoors that happens every single time we fly, whether it's a sunny VFR day with no wind or a howling blizzard. One of the most common backdoors that people do not leave themselves is, what's going to happen if I have an engine failure on climb out? We hear so many accidents, Bob, about, and a lot of spin stall accidents that happen as people are on their climb out, where in many cases they'll stall because they tried to make a 180 back to the airport instead of just continuing ahead into that cornfield. How do we get people in tune with thinking about that every time we fly?
Here is a scenario that every pilot can practice with great interest. Sit at the end of the sit at the end of the airport, the runway, just prior to departure, just prior to advancing full power, and just before you do that, ask yourself this one question: if the engine were to fail at 500 feet, now I know I'm not going to turn back to the airport, but I still have some options. Am I going to go straight out? Am I going to turn to the left? Or am I going to turn to the right based upon the terrain and other factors at the other end of the runway? Now, the students that I work with and many of the pilots I fly with, I ask this question, and very often I receive a blank stare back, even when operating from their own home airport. Now, some airports, most of the airports that I operate here in the East are fairly congested. But yet, of all of the congestion that exists out at the other end of that airport, there is, if you exercised a careful study, you will note that off of a particular runway, a right turn on an engine failure may give you precious seconds more than a left turn in terms of a safe outcome. I know, for example, Buffalo's runway 23. If we make a left turn, it's nothing but buildings and factories. If we make a right turn, we have a chance of reaching the New York State Thruway, four lanes of open highway. Now, neither one of those eventualities are good, but given the choice of going into buildings or putting it down on the center median of a four-lane highway, the latter option is definitely a better one.
Well, Bob, it's New York State. They're going to want to charge you a toll.
You better believe it. And those tolls have just gone up, believe me.
Well, this is something, I guess, to look at every airport we fly. I know that out west here, it's really entertaining to read the little green book and look at some of these Forest Service strips in Idaho, for example, where they're on the side of a mountain where it says caution 30-degree slope and boulders. But there's really no excuse at your home field for not having checked that out and thought about it thoroughly. And it's probably a good exercise to do the next time we're out there.
Well, yes, and even when landing at a first-time airport, look at the departure course, or look at the departure air space that you may have to come out on, and you can get an idea of what that is before even having to take off.
Well, Bob, you have the unique ability to make me think in ways that nobody else has up until now, and I always appreciate these Monday visits. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks a lot, Paul. My pleasure.
Find out more about Bob's writings and Over the Airwaves at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero-news.net. That's A-E-R-O. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.